share with you the results I found. So I want to say thank you to Latham for giving me this opportunity to speak. Okay, let me give a quick outline of what I'm going to talk about. So,
sorry, can you briefly introduce yourself?
Oh, yeah, I guess so. Probably a good idea. I'm Eric Ling. I'm from the University of Miami. Well, actually, I just graduated from the University of Miami, and so I'll be going to KTH Stockholm in the fall. Okay, so quick outline of what I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to give a quick review of the singularity theorems. These theorems are why we believe in, well, singularities. And then I'm going to talk about the Milne universe. Now, the Milne universe is a specific cosmological model, which extends past the Big Bang. But the Milne universe is isometric to a proper subset of Minkowski space. And we know that we don't live in Minkowski space, so we know that our universe is not modeled by the Milne universe. Okay, but then I'm going to talk about Milne-like spacetimes. Milne-like spacetimes are a generalization of the Milne universe in the sense that they also extend past the Big Bang. But now Milne-like spacetimes can model our observable universe. And then I'll talk about how the mathematics of these spacetimes may provide connections to certain problems in cosmology. Okay, the singularity theorems. So question, what is it that the singularity theorems actually prove? And what they prove is the existence of an incomplete geodesic. And it's this incomplete geodesic which is supposed to signal the breakdown of general relativity. This is the singularity. So let's start off with Penrose's original 1965 black hole singularity theorem. So in his theorem, one considers a spacetime with a non-compact Cauchy hypersurface, and we assume a trap surface S. A trap surface represents the surface of a collapsing star. And we assume the null energy condition. Then from these, we can conclude that there must be an incomplete null geodesic, the singularity. I'm going to quickly sketch the proof of Penrose's theorem, because if we're going to claim that this incomplete null geodesic represents the breakdown of general relativity, then it's a good idea to understand where it comes from. So we start off with our non-compact Cauchy hypersurface sigma. And inside sigma, we have our trap surface S. Now S represents the surface of a collapsing star. So if I were to depict this in a Penrose diagram, then this would be our Cauchy hypersurface, and this could be our trap surface S. So the idea is to look at the light that comes off of the collapsing star. And this would comprise S's light cone. Now, the fact that S is a trapped surface implies that S's light cone is going to reconverge in on itself. Okay, we're now ready to prove the existence of an incomplete null geodesic. And the proof is by contradiction. So suppose that every null geodesic from S is complete. Then the null energy condition implies that S's light cone is going to close up on itself. But this means that S's light cone is compact. But any compact light cone is itself a Cauchy surface. But we started off with a non-compact Cauchy surface. So on one hand, we have a compact Cauchy surface, S's light cone. And then on the other hand, we have a non-compact Cauchy surface, sigma. And all Cauchy surfaces are homeomorphic, and so this is a contradiction. And thus, our initial assumption that all null geodesics from S are complete is false, and therefore, there must exist an incomplete null geodesic. Okay, the strengths of Penrose's theorem are that there are no symmetry assumptions, and it has a reasonable energy condition. The null energy condition is the weakest among all energy conditions. And the weaknesses are that it doesn't prove curvature singularities, and it proves incompleteness of only one null geodesic. Okay, a few years later, Stephen Hawking developed his own singularity theorem, and his theorem proves the existence of cosmological type singularities. In his theorem, we consider a spacetime with a compact space-like hypersurface sigma. We assume sigma to have positive expansion. This makes sense because the universe is expanding, and we assume the strong energy condition. Then from these, we can conclude that there must be an incomplete time-like geodesic towards the past, which represents the Big Bang singularity. The strengths of Hawking's theorem are that there are no symmetry assumptions, and it has a reasonable energy condition. And the weaknesses are that it doesn't prove curvature singularities, and it proves incompleteness of only one time-like geodesic. Okay, what's up with this reasonable energy condition here? Well, it's the strong energy condition, which appears in Hawking's theorem, and it is obeyed by all classical matter models. But for FLRW spacetimes, the strong energy condition implies that rho plus 3p is non-negative. But rho plus 3p appears in Friedmann's equation as such. And thus, if the universe is accelerating, then rho plus 3p is negative, and that implies a violation of the strong energy condition. And thus, inflationary models do not satisfy the strong energy condition. So this reasonable energy condition, which first appeared as a strength for Hawking's theorem, really becomes a weakness for inflationary models. Now, this isn't Hawking's fault, because he developed his theorem before Alan Guth proposed inflationary theory. But it does raise a good question, which is, are there cosmological singularity theorems that don't rely on the strong energy condition? And so this was answered by Ward and Vilenkin in 1994. In their theorem, we consider a spacetime with a non-compact Cauchy hypersurface sigma, the null energy condition, not the strong energy condition, and then we assume a volume condition. And from this, we can conclude that there must be an incomplete null geodesic, which represents the Big Bang singularity. And the way they prove their theorem is that this volume condition allows them to run Penrose's argument backwards. So the strengths and weaknesses of their theorem are the same as Penrose's. I want to get my mouse out of the way. Okay. Well, Bohr and Vilenkin weren't completely satisfied with their theorem because this volume condition here is hard to justify physically, and the null energy, they found some models where the null, some models of inflationary theory where the null energy condition might be violated. So they teamed up with Alan Guth and produced another singularity theorem in 2003. So in their theorem, one considers a spacetime MG with a time-like geodesic congruence, and they assume that the Hubble expansion of this congruence is positive on average. And then from this, they can conclude that every geodesic is incomplete. So the strengths of their theorem are that there are no symmetry assumptions, no energy conditions, and it proves incompleteness of every geodesic. And the weaknesses are that it doesn't prove curvature singularities. Now,
sorry, there's another one that assumes it's expanding, but the average Hubble is positive.
Say again?
Was it H average?
Yeah, that was H average, yeah. Uh-huh. I had that. Okay, yeah. And despite the strengths of these theorem, there's a lot of strengths, it seems like there are some members of the mathematical relativity community who are not as big a fan of this theorem, and I think it's because some of the arguments that they use in this theorem are not the traditional arguments that one normally finds in the singularity theorems. But I actually like their theorem, because I think it closely resembles what we actually observe for our universe. We observe a time-like geodesic congruence given by the co-moving observers. We observe a positive Hubble expansion. Moreover, in the FLRW spacetimes, every geodesic is incomplete. So it seems like, at least I think, that their model does do a good job at representing the universe.
Isn't it true that if you apply it to the sitter itself, it just gives you a wrong answer? It just gives you the border of
Exactly. That is, so what happens in the sitter is that there's actually a boundary that stops the geodesics from continuing.
Mm-hmm. Coordinate.
Oh, it's a coordinate singularity, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true. Okay. Finally, let me end with a recent singularity theorem developed by my advisor and myself. So in our theorem, we consider a spacetime MG with a compact Cauchy hypersurface sigma, which is not a quotient of the three sphere. We assume that sigma is expanding in all directions. This means that its second fundamental form is positive definite. And we assume only the null energy condition, not the strong energy condition. And from this, we can conclude that there must be an incomplete null geodesic. And the way we prove our theorem is that this assumption on the Cauchy surface allows us to find trapped surfaces. We use recent results from three-manifold topology to find trapped surfaces, and then we run Penrose's argument backwards. And so the strengths and weaknesses of our theorem are the same as Penrose's. Okay, now let's talk about cases when we can extend the universe past the Big Bang. So the Milne universe is a specific cosmological model which does extend past the Big Bang. Let's see this. So this is the metric for the Milne universe. Tau represents the time of the co-moving observers, and h is the hyperbolic metric. The scale factor for the Milne universe is assumed to be equal to tau exactly. So if I were to graph the scale factor, it would look like this. Here is the metric written out in co-moving coordinates. Now the problem with writing the metric in these coordinates is that we don't actually see the hyperbolic nature of the spatial slices, and seeing is believing. So to see the hyperbolic nature, we're going to introduce new coordinates. And these new coordinates that we're going to introduce are little t and little r, and what they do is they parameterize the hyperboloids. Now, when you write out the metric in these coordinates, it's this, which is precisely the Minkowski metric. So this is what the Milne universe looks like in Minkowski space. Here are the tau equals constant surfaces, and now we're actually seeing their hyperbolic nature. And they foliate the Milne universe all the way down until you reach the light cone. Well, what does the light cone correspond to? So given our parameterization, hyperbolic trigonometry gives us this relation. And therefore, tau equals 0 corresponds to t equals r. but T equals R is the equation for the light cone, and so therefore the light cone corresponds to the Big Bang. So here, the light cone represents the surface of the Big Bang for the Milne universe, and it separates the Milne universe from the rest of Minkowski space.
Why do you call it a universe and a Big Bang?
Well, because tau equals zero. Well, because this was a model that Milne had developed. And I mean, if you look at the co-moving observers, their distances are all going to zero at tau equals zero, which would correspond to the Big Bang. Okay.
It's a universe, it's not the universe.
It's a universe. Good. Yeah, it's a universe. We're not. We know that we aren't, you know, modeled by the Milne universe, right?
He's just saying it's an example of an
effort. Okay. So now let's take a look at Milne-like spacetimes. They're a generalization of the Milne universe in the sense that they also extend past the Big Bang. So this is the metric for a Milne-like spacetime. H is the hyperbolic metric. And now we assume A of tau to satisfy an asymptotic condition at the Big Bang. So this was the metric, this was the scale factor for the Milne universe. For a Milne-like spacetime, all we're asking for is for it to be asymptotically tau. And then afterwards, one can have their inflationary era and then their radiation-dominated era. And so Milne-like spacetimes can model the dynamics of our universe. OK, well, hang on. Important question. Does this assumption contradict anything we know about the universe? Now, I've looked, and I haven't been able to find anything. But if you know of something, please let me know. I would be happy to hear it. And as a remark, this assumption on the scale factor implies that the particle horizon is infinite. And so these spacetimes correspond nicely to inflationary models. Again, we're going to introduce new coordinates. And what they do is they parameterize the hyperboloids. For the Milne universe, B of tau was equal to tau. But for Milne-like spacetime, it's going to be equal to this. And here, we're going to define omega to be 1 divided by B prime. And when we do that, the metric is this, which is conformal to Minkowski space. And again, I want to emphasize, all we've done here is a coordinate transformation. That's all. So this is what a Milne-like spacetime looks like in these coordinates. These are the tau equals constant slices, and we're seeing their hyperbolic nature. And they foliate this Milne-like spacetime. OK, well, what happens to the metric at the Big Bang? And the key point here is that this assumption on the scale factor implies that omega of 0 is positive. So omega of 0 is positive. This is what the metric looks like. And thus, there's no degeneracy in the metric at the Big Bang. And so therefore, theorem, the Big Bang is a coordinate singularity for Milne-like spacetimes. Now, there seems to be some confusion surrounding this theorem. And I want to try and clarify things. So question, what does a coordinate singularity mean? Well, if you read textbooks, what you'll find is that a coordinate singularity means not a real singularity. Now, this is a problem, because we just proved that the Big Bang was a coordinate singularity, right? Does that mean that the Big Bang is not a real singularity? No, that's not what that means. What's wrong here is this interpretation. This interpretation that a coordinate singularity means not a real singularity is a bad interpretation. What a coordinate singularity really means is new geometry to explore. That's all. So for example, in Schwarzschild, the new geometry to explore was the R equals 2m event horizon. And exploring this new geometry was a good idea. It led to Hawking's area theorem for black holes, which was pivotal to the development of black hole thermodynamics. What's the new geometry to explore for a Milne-like spacetime? It's this light cone. OK, well, what about the singularity theorems? Well, my singularity theorem doesn't apply because we assume a compact Cauchy hypersurface, and these tau equals constant surfaces are non-compact.
Can I just ask, what is wrong with the interpretation that you mentioned? Isn't it true that in these spacetimes that the actual blue dotted line there is not a singularity? I mean, can't you?
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, it's just a coordinate singularity. But I do think that these blue dashed lines represent where the Big Bang occurred. And I don't want to say that the Big Bang is not a singularity, because I do believe that the Big Bang is singular. So, yeah.
Not a physical coordinate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can calculate all the curvature variants, and they're all zero on that. So I mean, it's not.
Yeah. So what I'll.
Another way of saying
Well, I have a theorem which will prove that there, if you give it an assumption, there will be no curvature singularities, like no divergences in the any scalar invariant of curvature. Mm-hmm. Okay, but I want to look at the Guth board and Vilenkin singularity theorem, because their singularity theorem does apply. So let's take a look at their theorem in terms of the Milne universe. Then, in terms of the Milne universe, this would be an example of an incomplete time-like geodesic that their theorem predicts. But that geodesic extends to a complete geodesic in Minkowski space. And what was interesting about their theorem was that every geodesic is incomplete. And indeed, any geodesic we find is indeed going to be incomplete. But we can extend each of these geodesics to a complete one in Minkowski space. So is their theorem wrong? No. The theorem isn't wrong. It only applies to the spacetime on which the congruence is defined. The spacetime is not defined past this congruence, past the light cone. Okay, well, what about curvature singularities? So recall that one of the weaknesses among all of the singularity theorems was that they don't prove curvature singularities. Well, it could be because they're not necessarily there. And so I proved a theorem. If you consider this asymptotic assumption, then there are no curvature singularities. And so one way to understand this is if you Taylor expand the scale factor and you assume C2 and C4 are zero, then there are no curvature singularities. So I think that this is interesting that there are physically relevant spacetimes out there that don't have curvature singularities. Now, this asymptotic assumption is necessary. You can find models of Milne-like spacetimes that do extend past the Big Bang, where it's just a coordinate singularity, but you still have a curvature singularity. Last thing, if we take a look at a Milne-like spacetime, what's so special about the origin? Well, it's the co-moving observers. The co-moving observers all come from the origin. And to see that, consider a hyperboloid. The co-moving observers have to be orthogonal to the hyperboloid. So they have to look like this. Remember, this is space-time orthogonality. And so what's interesting is that all the co-moving observers come from the origin. They're all emanating from the origin. And so I like to think that the origin is the Big Bang singularity for Milne-like spacetimes. OK, now let me discuss how the mathematics of these spacetimes may provide connections to certain problems in cosmology. So the cosmological constant appears in the Einstein equations as such. And the thing to note is that the cosmological constant is a constant. And so it must have been fixed at the Big Bang. And so what I wanted to see was, could I write the cosmological constant in terms of some sort of initial condition of our universe? And so what I found was, if you consider a Milne-like spacetime that satisfies this assumption on the scale factor, and the energy momentum tensor goes to zero at the Big Bang, then what you find is that lambda is equal to 3 times a triple prime of 0. And you can relate that back to the scalar curvature. And the proof of this is nothing more than an application of the Friedmann equations. And so I think it's interesting that we can find a way to relate the cosmological constant in terms of some sort of initial geometrical quantity. OK, what lies beyond the Big Bang? And of course, this is speculative territory, but yeah?
Sorry, before you go there, can I just understand the previous slide? So I mean, you're just saying that if I take consider an affiliated open slices,
Why is that related back to lambda?
Well, I'm just considering it's just the space-time constant versus.
Yeah. But this isn't consider.
Why not?
Because consider has a specific scale factor. The sitter is a Milne-like spacetime with the scale factor being sinh, A of tau is equal to sinh of tau. Whereas for a general Milne-like spacetime, all we're asking for is that asymptotic condition that I had written earlier.
But I mean, you set the energy momentum tensor to zero as tau goes to zero.
Yeah.
So, and the scale factor is just sinh at s.
Okay, so you're right. Yeah. So as an initial condition, you're right. As an initial condition, it does appear like how it appears for a sinh, and in fact, or for the sitter. And in fact, you can actually generalize what I did here. So for example, if you don't assume the energy momentum tensor goes to zero, you can have another theorem. But what you have is that the energy density and pressure function take the form of a cosmological constant. The equation of state takes the form of a cosmological constant. So you take away this assumption, T mu nu goes to zero, and what you'll find is this initial condition, which is kind of like the sitter, right? Because that's basically what the sitter does. what lies beyond the Big Bang? And so this is very clearly speculative territory, but we have extended the universe past the Big Bang, and so you can legitimately ask, well, what lives in the extension? And what I think lives there is the universe's missing antimatter. And I think this because of Lorentz invariance. So what I show is that the elements in the Lorentz group act by isometries on Milne-like spacetimes. To see this, consider what does a Lorentz transformation do? It just shifts points on the hyperboloid. It's kind of like how the rotation group shifts points on a sphere. The Lorentz transformation, a Lorentz transformation, shifts points on the hyperboloid. So for example, it would take this point P here to another point Q, but it has to do so on the same hyperboloid. Well, notice that omega is a function of tau. And so omega of tau of P is going to be equal to omega of tau of Q. And so if you apply a Lorentz transformation to this metric, omega is not going to change, and the Minkowski metric is surely Lorentz invariant, and so the whole thing is Lorentz invariant. Okay, to be a little bit more precise, recall that the Lorentz group has four connected components. The up, the plus or minus corresponds to the determinant being plus or minus, the up arrow corresponds to leaving t big and the zero unchanged, and the down arrow corresponds to changing t to negative t. Well, it's only the up arrow that acts by isometries on Milne-like spacetimes, and this is because Milne-like spacetimes are only defined for t positive. Okay, well, what about the down arrow? If the down arrow also acts by isometries, then there would be a universe isometric to ours under this PT transformation. Here, P stands for parity reversal, and T stands for time reversal. And so, if the down arrow also acts by isometries, then we would have a PT symmetric universe. And given the CPT theorem from quantum field theory, I think that that PT symmetric universe is our universe's missing antimatter. And fortunately for me, I'm not the only one with this crazy idea. So Neil Turek, Lathan Boyle, and Finn also have an idea that the universe's missing antimatter is in a PT symmetric universe, but there are subtle differences between what they do and what I do. And so we both start off with FLRW spacetimes. I start off with hyperbolic slices, and they start off with Euclidean slices. We then move to a spacetime which is conformal to Minkowski space. They do theirs by moving to conformal time. But for them, the metric is degenerate at the Big Bang, and their singularity corresponds to a Weyl singularity. While for me, I have a non-degenerate metric at the Big Bang. Okay, let's turn to representation theory now of the Lorentz group. And here we're motivated by Wigner's classification of the Poincaré group.
Can I just ask one question about the previous slide?
Yep.
Why, when you're drawing your space time, are you only drawing the upper and lower quadrants? Why not the left and right quadrants?
Because, because you see this light cone here, let's ignore the bottom part here. A Milne-like spacetime only is part of the future light cone. And so I can't actually say anything reasonable past the light cone, because that light cone kind of acts like a Cauchy horizon. And because it acts like a Cauchy horizon, determinism ends there. So I don't really know what lives beyond that. And so what's over here and over here, I don't really know.
I said equations are time reversible. So if you know what happens in there, you go backwards in time, and you know what happened beyond that.
But I think the problem is the Einstein equations are well posed only for a globally hyperbolic set. And the global hyperbolicity ends at that Cauchy horizon. It ends at the light cone. And so this is why it's hard for me to say what really goes on past that light cone. And the only reason why I say this part right here is because this part comes from the other part of the Lorentz group. So I don't know what's happening here. I don't know what's happening here. But if we assume that the other part of the Lorentz group is also acting by isometries, then we get this antimatter part, the PT symmetric part. I don't know if I really want to call it the antimatter part.
I guess doesn't it stop being a manifold, though, with the other thing there?
No, the manifold is fine. Mm-hmm. Okay, representation theory. So here we're motivated by Wigner's classification of the Poincaré group. How is the manifold defined? Well, they're defined by these coordinates, t and x.
I mean, at the original boundary, is the breakdown being a manifold too?
No, the manifold is perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. Assuming you have a CK metric, a CK scale factor, then the manifold will be CK plus 1. Mm-hmm. And so in our assumption, we only assume A, the scale factor, to be C0. And so that means that the manifold is C1. and then any C1 manifold emits a C infinity subatlas. So you can even take these manifolds to be smooth if you wanted to. Okay, representation theory, motivated by weakness classification of the Poincaré group. So we're seeking the irreducible unitary representations of the Lorentz group. Well, we're actually seeking them for SL2C. SL2C is the simply connected cover of the Lorentz group, and we do this because we want projective representations to lift to unitary representations. And what you find...
Can I ask one more question about the previous slide? Sorry.
It's okay.
Suppose I have a light ray that comes, that I follow it back and it hits the blue dotted line.
Yes.
Does it, is the idea that you're mentioning that that's glued to the lower light?
No. No.
It just passes out.
It would just pass here.
And never reaches the bottom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what's hard for me to, and I have thought about things like this before, but what's hard for me to understand is, like, I can't see how a light ray could do that. Because you would have to think, because remember, this light cone really corresponds to the surface of the Big Bang. And so what that means is that, like, there was a light particle that was coming from that surface and going upwards, right? But all of the cone-moving observers emanated from this origin here. So it's hard for me to kind of conceive how that would happen.
Maybe we would have a non-cone-moving observer.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you could. Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be co-moving.
That's true. Yeah, you could. I mean, you could definitely write, you can draw a time like curves that would go like this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me analogous to if you take the Schwarzschild spacetime and you extend it to, you know, the full
maximum
Schwarzschild spacetime, but you only kept the left and right squares and you didn't keep the part behind the horizon. If it
Wait, you say for Schwarzschild or De Sitter?
In Schwarzschild, you have this coordinate singularity at the horizon.
Uh-huh.
You follow behind it, and normally you include that section,
part
behind the horizon in space. And then the maximal extension also has this other part on the other side, which is related, so there's a square on the other side, which is related by dt to the square.
Yeah.
I think those two are quite analogous for the upper and lower.
I think so too, actually, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in that analogy, you would keep, I mean, the space time out on the left and right would still be real.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Cauchy surface, the actual Cauchy surface in that sense would be the one that would cover the ball.
It is confusing, and I don't actually know how to interpret this area. That's my problem. Because I'm comfortable with Milne-like spacetimes because I know that that's just a model for the universe, and I know that they just end right here. But I know that you can extend it. So it's hard for me to be comfortable to say, how does the extension happen? So we're seeking the irreducible unitary representations of SL2C. And what you find are two classes of particles, the principal series and the complementary series. And so if you recall, all the co-moving observers emanated from the origin in the Big Bang. And so I think one way to interpret these particles is that they are the particles created at the Big Bang. Now, if you follow Wigner's classification of the Poincaré group, the principal series would correspond to the particles of the Standard Model. But then this leaves the complementary series up to interpretation. And so I had a hunch that, well, maybe the complementary series is dark matter. And so the thing to note here is that the complementary series has spin zero. So is there any evidence that dark matter is comprised of spin zero particles? So there is. Scalar field dark matter, also known as Bose-Einstein condensate dark matter, also known as wave dark matter, and Ed Witten all use the Klein-Quaterne equation to model dark matter. So they all independently came up with the idea to use the Klein-Quaterne equation because they all found independently that if you use the Klein-Quaterne equation to model dark matter, then you can explain some of the patterns in galactic structure. In particular, I want to look at the wave dark matter group, which is led by Hugh Bray at Duke University. And so I'm not sure if you can see it because of the light and stuff, but the left here is a galaxy, and the right is one of their simulations using the Klein-Quaterne equation to model dark matter. And the left is a galaxy, and the right is a simulation. I don't know if you can see it or not. You might be able to see it better here, actually. And then the left is a simulation, and the right is one of their, sorry, the left is a galaxy, and the right is one of their simulations. And so,
what would the simulation start from?
They assume a Klein-Quaterne equation, they have like physical parameters. So for example, the mass of the, you know, for this wave dark matter to work, the Compton wavelength has to be like 1 kiloparsec. And so they input these types of parameters, and then they fudge with them to see, you know, if they can get things that look like, you know, galaxies that we actually observe.
What kind of initial conditions is this? Essentially flat with a bit of perturbation, or
I think they use flat FLRW models, and they like they do some sort of expansion.
FLRW or
cosmological simulations. I think they're just talking about.
I think they're not cosmological. They're just focusing more on locally at around a galaxy.
Well, do they include gravity, like Newtonian gravity, or is
this
just the wave equation?
I think it's just the wave equation. It's just the wave equation.
Otherwise, you don't get clumping. The potential is the gravitational potential.
Yeah, so I think the metric they use is probably the like 1 - 2m/r dt² that potential. Okay. Yeah. But I don't actually fully know exactly what they do, so like don't ask me too many questions. Okay. So because of the simulations, I think that these guys are like onto something, I can't really say, which makes me think that perhaps maybe the complementary series might be dark matter. I don't know.
You know, you can do the same things with fermionic dark matter, right?
Say again?
You can do the same thing with fermionic dark matter too.
With fermionic dark matter, like get the same spiral structure?
Every other simulation that's been run
does the same thing. But then there's also like, well, at least the core cusp problem, right? That tends to exist for fermionic matter, dark matter.
Maybe go on, I mean,
yeah, you don't need to get
gravity. Okay.
So then you see structures.
Huh?
If you have gravity, it's going to plumb.
Uh huh.
So you're going to see structures like that.
But the spirals? The spirals, I'm not entirely sure that you'll see.
Like, you know, momentum conservation. So I think many of these features are quite linear.
Spirals are all a result of baryonic physics, right? All you're getting.
No, the spirals have been a mystery, at least from what I know. The spirals have been a mystery for like 100 or so years. But again, I'm not an expert, so I don't want to claim anything. These guys, I think they probably know a lot better than I do. So I can see you biting your tongue. Anyways, it's just a hunch. I think it's interesting that if you look at the irreducible unitary representations of this group, you get two types of particles. One type of particles is the principal series, which by Wigner's classification, is the same particles that we call the standard model. And then you get another group of particles. I think that that's just interesting. Okay, last thing I want to talk about very quickly is unitarity in quantum mechanics. So the unitary postulate of quantum mechanics states that the time evolution of the wave function is described by a unitary operator. And so this allows us to infer that psi squared at late times is the probability distribution function, which gives Born's rule. Now, a question is, well, where does this unitary operator come from? Well, it normally comes from solving a wave equation and then exponentiating. So where does the wave equation come from? Well, it comes from the Schrodinger equation. Well, we know that the Schrodinger equation is a low velocity approximation of the Dirac equation. And the appealing thing about the Dirac equation was that it was Lorentz invariant. So I wanted to see if I can find a Lorentz invariant Dirac equation for Milnik spacetimes. So consider a Milnik spacetime with metric g, and consider a particle with mass m. Then the four momentum is given by such. And then if you assume the de Broglie relations, what you find is that this yields a Lorentz invariant Klein-Gordon equation. Now, if I remove the omega here, that is the Klein-Gordon equation for Minkowski space. But with the omega, it becomes a Lorentz invariant Klein-Gordon equation for Milnik spacetimes. Likewise, we have a Lorentz invariant Dirac equation. If I remove the omega, it becomes the Dirac equation on Minkowski space, but with the omega, it becomes a Lorentz invariant Dirac equation for Milnik spacetimes. And if you write this out in co-moving coordinates, this equation is equivalent to this. And so this equation is very simple, but it expresses a lot. It expresses Lorentz invariance, it expresses linearity, and it also explains why all the co-moving observers have the same proper time. So if someone were to ask me, where does the wave equation come from? I think it's this. Okay, thank you, I'm done.
Let's do one quick question and we'll set up the next speaker. And you set up all these assumptions. The t mean u is taken to be zero.
No, it's not. It's not. It doesn't have to be taken to be zero.
So I'm thinking, in reality, like there is some physical correlation of matter, which would prefer slicing from being a fundamental correlation.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a equal to zero, then the actual pattern is limiting for that.
like the energy density of them? Well, so if you assume like in you know if you assume those assumptions I have were like for the scale curvature, and if you assume these assumptions that allowed me to calculate lambda, then what you'll find is that the energy density and pressure function don't diverge. They'll also converge at the Big Bang. I had only lambda, but the other ones will converge.
Some like matter, actual matter form.
Yeah. It will converge. Yes. If you assume these assumptions on the scale factor that I have, then they will converge.
So those assumptions on the same universe has to be dominated by the curvature.
I guess
if the bigger matter, then
Cool, thank you.
Can you get your microphone?
Yeah. This is such as pulls off.
Something in the blackboard. We'll see if I need to show slides. Leave it out.
Leave it up?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so I don't really have anything prepared. I thought we would talk a little bit about I think we need this. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about this H not
in. Since it will be recorded, you
oh really?
Yes.
So then I should have prepared something.
No, Cliff wanted it to be recorded, that's why. Sorry. Next week everything will be, you know...
Back to normal. All right.
Again.
So, I've been trying to think for the last couple of years about this H0 and sigma 8 problem, just mostly for my own benefit in terms of should I be working on it? So it's a sort of a summary of what I found, so it might be useful for you guys. I don't really have any really hard-nosed conclusions, but things are sort of at an interesting stage, and hopefully they'll get more interesting as things go on. Okay. So this is based on mostly on a paper that came out. Recently, so I'll write the archive number. And the idea here was to look at these two tensions that people have talked a lot about, which is this H0 and sigma 8 tensions. And so I'll define them in just a bit. So this has been around for a while. I'm guessing most of you have heard about this. The H0 tension sort of is a summary of looking at different data sets. So one is the CMB, and then you have, so this is sort of the high redshift. And then you have low redshift data from BAO, supernovae. And then you have a local measurement of H0. And the statement is that if you take the CMB with lambda CDM assumptions that you know the universe is basically lambda CDM, and take the measurements at the last scattering surface, extrapolate it down three orders of magnitude in the scale factor, then you're going to get an H naught that's different from the locally measured value. So from the CMB, you'll get something like 67, and the H naught locally measured is something more like 72 or 73. And you know, at first blush, it's exciting that you're even that close. Right? Even within my lifetime, you know, this seems pretty spectacular because we've seen, like, you know, just saying it's 60 or 70 was sort of good enough. But you know, it's come down to this point that, you know, practitioners of those who support like these local measurements, they feel like they can get things down to plus or minus 1 kilometer per second. Okay, so the recent claims are that not too far in the future, you will know H naught to like 72 plus or minus one, right? Which is pretty amazing. The BAO and the CMB play an important part here. As you're aware, the BAO and the CMB measure some combination of parameters. So in particular, the BAO would be measuring, so depending on what you're trying to do, I mean, you could be measuring things along the line of sight or perpendicular to it. So they are measuring, for example, H at the redshift where you have your, where your survey is concentrated times the sound horizon, okay, which is something that comes from the time when the baryons decouple from the CMB. All right, so you measure a combination like this, okay, and the supernovae are doing a similar thing. You have the luminosity distance at whatever redshift you have the supernovae at, and then you need to like, and this is times H naught. Right? So that's sort of the dimension-free things that these guys measure. This is just wherever your BAO is. Like, so if you're looking at luminous red galaxies, you know, like 0.5 or so, if you're looking at the BOSS Lyman Alpha QSO, then that's more like redshift of 2. Okay, so and then this is really the decoupling redshift, but it's just basically measured out of the early universe, right? And so in order to know this, you need the CMB, right? So one thing you could do is you could say, what does the CMB plus BAO, how does that look compared to the supernova plus H naught? Right? So you could ask this question of CMB plus BAO, you know, does this agree with, like, you know, supernova plus H naught, right? And they don't. These two data sets don't agree with each other, although independently, they'll both tell you that the universe is accelerating, right? So that's sort of one way to like summarize this. And maybe at the end, in a couple of minutes, I'll show you a plot that'll make this somewhat clearer. All right, let's see. So is this clear? You need something because a supernova is measuring like, you know, a luminosity distance times H naught, right? So even if you ignore the supernova, yeah, you would still get the tension. Yeah, the tension is true. But I'm just saying, like, these two guys are internally also not consistent with each other. There's a couple of percent tension there. But yeah, you could just do CMB plus BAO, and then you could measure the expansion history, and there is that tension. You could do supernovae plus H naught, and there is a tension. But a key point, and this was made by earlier, or at the end of last year by the Davis group, Ehler et al., is that the low redshift measurements are not consistent amongst themselves, in the sense that if you try to do this and estimate what is the expansion rate from Z of 0 to, let's say, Z of 1 or 2, then they won't agree with each other. And that's about a 2 to 3% discrepancy. So how can you fix this? Well, one easy way to fix this guy, fix sort of a lot of these problems, is to just say that this thing that comes out of the CMB is different, right? So you assume no new physics of the CMB, you know, your usual six parameters cosmological model, and then you get some estimate of RS, okay? But for whatever reason, let's just say that RS is different, right? If RS is different, now the things you measure from the BAO come out different. Right? If you change this, let's say you push this up, then H goes down, or you push this down, H goes up. Does that make sense? Right? And then you can actually get the BAO plus CMB to basically line up with the supernovae in H naught. And also you get the H naught coming out at, like, you know, 72 kilometers per second, right? So this was the point that Ehler had all made, is that change RS and everything becomes okay. Okay, so that's the first thing to sort of, like, you know, take away, is that that's a very nice thing to do to make all the low redshift data consistent and get H naught to be 72.
Sound horizon be bigger or smaller?
Sound horizon has to be a little bigger. A little bit smaller.
Yeah.
So you, to push H up.
Right.
And that's the tack that everybody's taken in the literature with respect to solving this problem, which is changing the sound horizon. Right. So what do you need to do to change the sound horizon? Well, you've got to change something about the physics of the last scattering. The easiest way is to change the expansion rate at last scattering, right? And so if you want to make the sound horizon smaller, you make the expansion rate a little larger. Right? And you can do this in various ways. So one thing would be, you know, you add some extra components. So for example, you could have dark energy at recombination. So this is now for the sound horizon, okay? So we are trying to change the sound horizon. You could have some extra radiation. And there's something else I'm forgetting. All right, but just let's leave it like this for now. Now, just adding extra radiation, if you just change the expansion rate, that's, you know, you don't just change the sound horizon, you change the peak structure, right? So this is really not the right, even though it is really sold as one of the ways in which you can solve the problem, just dumping in extra radiation is not preferred by the data. Okay, you muck up the CMB enough that if you put in all the small scale CMB data plus the polarization, this is not the preferred solution. It doesn't really want you to do this. Okay. So there's one recent work where you do, for example, maybe that's what I was missing, you have interacting neutrinos. And these are your, these neutrinos are the active neutrinos. So you add some non-standard interactions for them. All right, so they're all trying to change the sound horizon at last scattering surface, but keep the entire structure of the peaks, in a sort of, like, you know, in the same way, you know, that we have with lambda CDM. Right? So that's one option. Typically, as far as I can tell from looking at all these solutions, when you do this, what tends to happen is, so for example, if you're looking at a sigma 8 H naught plane, so if you're looking at look at H naught omega matter plane, something like this, I forget which way the contours will go, but, or maybe, so, so before, your contours might look like this. So this is lambda CDM. And typically the contours with new physics, I'm sort of, like, you know, brushing all of this new physics into one thing, but almost every one of them looks the same. The contours with new physics at recombination looks sort of like this. The blob becomes bigger, and it becomes big enough that essentially 72 kilometers per second per megaparsec is now allowed by the data. I haven't really seen any solution where this thing just keeps the same size and just shifts up. So in a way, it's good. It says that if you get more data, and the data just sharpens around the same mean value, then all of these solutions go out of the door. Right. On the other hand, you know, the new data could sort of, like, you know, move in different ways. Right? So one way to think about these things is you're adding extra parameters, new parameters to your model, lambda CDM model, and that's sort of making your prediction for what H naught is today more uncertain. Okay. And I think that's genetically true for all of these early universe solutions. Okay. And there are other things you can do, which I'm not listing here. There are things you can do where the dark matter is coupled to some dark radiation. There are these partially acoustic dark matter models. So they're very interesting models where you can change H naught and sigma 8 at the same time. And they're all sort of trying to do the same thing, which is muck around with stuff at Z of a few thousand, right? All right, so since a lot of this work had been done along these lines, what I wanted to do was to ask, like, okay, what happens if I don't go this route and we keep the high redshift stuff fixed? So you don't think there's any new physics at around the last scattering surfaces before. What does the solution look like? Right? Which is to say that I'm no longer allowed to change RS. Right? What does the solution look like? Okay. And the solution is pretty interesting. I'll come back to this point here in just a bit. But you throw in the same data sets that people have played with before, which is CME, BAO, Supernova, H0. So one of the things we did is we try to do this in a model independent way. So we basically ran a Gaussian process where your random variable was the expansion rate at different redshifts. So we tried to reconstruct the expansion history using a Gaussian process. And I won't show you the result for that, but what I'll show you is what is the inferred equation of state for dark energy look like. Now this is sort of a model independent method, so this equation of state is a weird thing to be talking about. But what we ended up doing was we said that we know that there is no new physics at the last scattering surface in this way of doing things. So you can estimate the matter density very well at the last scattering surface, right? Because there's no new physics. So as soon as you give me the expansion rate at last scattering surface, I can turn that into a matter density. And then I can evolve it just by saying, the usual, evolve it as a to the minus 3, right? So I can evolve the matter density forward with this assumption, and then at late times, compute whatever is left over from my expansion rate using the Friedman equation, and that would be my dark energy density. So you could just compute an effective dark energy density the usual way. And this rho matter is coming from there, right? And then you can plot its equation of state. And what it looks like is the following. Once you see it, you'll see why, sort of like kind of obvious that it had to come out this way. This is minus 1, and the equation of state sort of looks like. Right, and this transition here is sort of around Z of 1.
That's minus 1.
This is minus 1, right? And so the reconstructed equation of state, again, no new physics at the last scattering surface. Take all the data we have from BOS, from the latest supernova compilation, the latest H0, and CMB. And for the H0, what we did, I should say this is kind of important. So there's an assumption here that we know H0 to 1 kilometer per second. The current constraints are the 1 sigma errors of 1.6 around 2 kilometers per second. So this is basically saying if this tension is real and down the road you will know it to 1 kilometer per second, then what must be the solution? Okay, so sort of forcing the fits to give you the solution that would give you H0 of 72 kilometers per second. And we chose 1 kilometer per second because that's the number everyone's been throwing around as something that's possible down the road. Okay, so we kept the mean fixed to what it's now, and we just said that what if the error bar shrinks to 1 kilometer per second? And this is the solution you get, all right? So this is interesting for two reasons. One is that there's this transition in the equation of state. So it goes from being very negative to mimicking something that looks like the dark energy today. And it does so at, you know, redshifts of sort of beyond like, you know, z of one, right? If you run this forward from here, what it means is it's matter, 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 matter. And at some point, all of a sudden, dark energy just comes up. It's almost like, you know, there was a phase transition or something like that happened, and then dark energy peaks up. So there's no fluctuations in the data right now. So I'll talk about that in just a second. Right, in this data is all distances. So this is just strictly asking.
No, this is not CMB.
No, the CMB is, so the reason why I can do this is I'm saying there's no physics of this last scattering surface, new physics, right? So it really looks like just a matter dominated universe. Yeah, so and in fact, you know, yeah, so something very strange has to happen. In terms of model building, the only good point here is like, you know, it doesn't really have to asymptote to minus one. You don't need a de Sitter phase in this. You could imagine doing other things where this goes to like, you know, in fact, this widens in the future. So you could have equations of state that look like cosmic strings or domain walls, whatever you wanted. So the W of Z is not modeled. We are really just actually doing a Gaussian process for H of Z. So we're just inferring W of Z from it, right? So there's no model as such in there. There's no cosmological model in here.
So you read
off
the H and then you fit it
and the W. Yeah, you just take derivatives.
There must have some relative bins for this, right?
Yeah, we just estimated it. But it's a Gaussian process. Yeah.
The Gaussian process requires a choice of smoothing scales.
Yeah, so we allow it to vary, and then the data fixes it itself. So the meta parameters, the smooding scale and the height, the high parameters, yeah, so that's varied.
Do you know roughly what smoothing scale you finish up with?
I don't remember off the top of my head, but I can look it up in here.
Is the Gaussian process done in redshift or in scale factor?
So we tried a few different things. In the end, you know, the variable we used was log 1 plus z. Just because we need to cover like an entire, a long, a huge range from z of 0 to 1,000.
That's true, up to a point, but clearly with the W you find the dark energy is going to be completely irrelevant beyond redshift of 2 or 3. Even if it was flat, it would be irrelevant.
But you,
2 or 3, so.
But you need the CMB, otherwise this doesn't work, right? You need to like anchor. You need to know what the DA or DH is at the last scattering surface.
But at some suitably high redshift, say redshift 5, you could just assume that dark energy is negligible beyond that and don't care about what it is. Is that what you're assuming? Because
so remember, there's no model here, right? It really is just modeling you know, H as a Gaussian process, right? So there's no dark energy, there's nothing in here.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Just by extrapolating it to some high redshift, you're imposing some kind of prior on the kinds of models that you're considering. That's like an important point. So
I think it is an important point. I mean, you know, that so whatever you do, you want to make sure that, you know, you hit the CMB. And in particular, this behavior is really only coming because you want the expansion rate at some point to be like what you see at the last scattering surface.
And the W, you can do anything at all beyond redshift.
Yeah, exactly. So the constraint. Oh yeah, this constraint just goes to the dogs at high redshift. There's no constraint at all.
Nothing at all.
I mean,
if it becomes part of it could be important at every time. So you could have dark energies.
You could do what you want between z of 2 and 1,000 as long as you end up getting back the CMB.
So you should put it as a prior in your Gaussian process. That is. Should become like CMB standard.
That's what I'm saying we do, right? So the CMB is a prior on it. But without that, you're not going to get this result. Yeah. So it's exploring a really huge prior space. You know, you're allowing it to do like a huge amounts of stuff. Some of it is probably just unphysical. But at the end of the day, this is what comes out. So the one way we checked this was to then just do a parametric thing where we just you put in an actual model. And we say rho dark energy varies as like, you know, some 1 plus c raised to some function. And we had a couple of parameters in this function. and we did this, and you get back the same results. So you can see that, you know, those plots in the paper. But basically, you need a sharp transition here. And that sharp transition is really only coming because you want to asymptote back to the CMB. You want to get the angular diameter distance to the CMB, right? You can't muck around with it.
And is the absolute fit, how does the absolute fit for the best pairing WZ model here? How does it compare to the early
That we haven't done. We only compared to the lambda CDM model, right? So if you do something parametric like this, then in terms of a base factor is like overwhelmingly preferred over a lambda CDM model with just this data set. So it really wants a transition. But that's not surprising.
You have to be overwhelmingly prepared because the tension you're originally trying to display is only 4 signals. So you can't possibly produce more than 4 signals worth of reference.
No, I mean, you know, that depends on how good a fit it is, right? I mean, the tension in lambda CDM is sort of like the 3 sigma, but so I can tell. I mean, I can tell you what the base factor is for there. I'll look up the, you know, so like the base factor, and the lambda CDM model, the log k is about 6.8. Which is 6 is sort of like this thing which says it's strong, mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So that's all I mean. I didn't, you know, how that translates into, you know, these this H naught versus this 3 sigma. I mean, the H naught sigma 8, the H naught CMB tension is sort of like 3-point-something sigma anyway. Right. So, I think it's consistent, you know, with what it is. So we haven't put in the sigma 8 yet. This is really just distances as of now. But then you can ask, okay, so the next question you can ask is like, you know, what can you do with the growth history? So we don't have a model here, right? So this is a little harder to do. But one thing you can say is like, let's compute the growth history. And since this is, you know, I'm running out of time, I'll just you can compute the growth history. Again, this is a model-dependent statement based on the expansion rate alone. So this is, in a sense, saying that there's no new degrees of freedom that contribute to the growth. If you try to like just use the expansion rate to compute the growth history, what do you get? And what you get is that basically, you know, the growth rate f, in the lambda CDM, it looks like this. In this case, at redshifts below 1. You see this behavior that the growth rate is suppressed. Okay?
Can I try to express more clearly why I find that result surprising? You have a tension that may be about 4 sigma. If you introduce a different model that only precisely predicts the data that's arrived, you can be that 4 sigma best off.
I mean, it might be 4 sigma. I'm not saying anything. I'm just telling you the base factor was like 6.8.
Yeah, I guess an argument I don't believe in. The specific reason I don't believe it is that the base factor predictiveness of your models. It's true probably that in some region of your parameter space you can get a better fit of the data between its tensions.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time you've expanded the model space in a way which is going to introduce lots more value models which are also rubbish fits to the data, may even be worse than the others. So you've taken a huge loss of predictive power in your model to set against a possible gain in fit to the data, which at most can be 4 sigma. And this factor of 6 corresponds to a probability of something like 1,000 to 1.
Which one are you talking about? Are you talking about the Gaussian process? I mean, the Gaussian process, we can't compute any such thing,
yeah.
Right? The base factor that we talked about is only for this particular model, right? So this model just is sort of like the W0WA model, except that, you know, it's slightly different just to allow for the possibility of a transition. So it has 2 parameters, just like the WAW. So there's nothing unphysical in the sense that if you're allowed to write down an energy density that's positive and can vary with redshift, then that's what this is.
Yeah, I'm just concerned that you must be introducing lots of models which are proof based to the data as well as providing a model parameter to get better. So you can't do as well as 4 sigmas worth of improvement.
So I maybe you're stuck on this 4 sigma. I didn't say 4. I mean, I'm just telling you the base factor was 6.8. Right. So if you take, for example,
so that was for your prior on H naught.
Yeah, of 1 kilometer per second.
The current 4 sigma is not 4, right? 1 kilometer per second.
Forecast. Oh, okay. Yeah. So this. So I should say to preface this, the reason why we did this is because if you take the data as it is today with 2 kilometers per second, then the Gaussian process itself will not give you a preference. I mean, it just doesn't, it allows for a whole range of histories, and there's really no transition you can see.
Okay, I see, I misunderstood that point.
Yeah, so the whole point of this paper was to say, look, down the road, if there's a real tension, we will know it to 1 kilometer per second, then what happens? Right, yeah, okay. So that makes sense? All right, so anyway, so the growth history is suppressed in this way, which then you can try to turn into, you know, and ask, like, what does this say for cosmic shear power spectrum? What does it say about the, you know, the SZ clusters, all of which actually speak to the sigma 8 tension? So I don't know. I think we're running. Do you want to take 2 minutes to talk about the sigma 8? Right. So I'll just say a couple of things, and then again we can stop. So this, just like this H naught tension, the sigma 8 is I would say, somewhat on a weaker footing as far as tensions go. There's two sources for this. One is just looking at cluster abundance. So this is really measuring the number density of clusters as a function of redshift, right? And the other one is sort of the two-point correlation function for cosmic shear. I'm just going to write cosmic shear. Right. Now this one, if you compare, and again, what you're doing is you're taking the CMB, taking the power spectrum that's measured at the CMB, extrapolating it forward under the assumption of a lambda CDM universe, measuring the sigma 8 at late times, and then asking how consistent is that with actual local actual measurements at low redshift, right? And that's, so this extrapolation doesn't quite agree with, and so this the difference that typically comes out is like 10 to 15%. With the measurements being lower than the extrapolation from the CMB, right? And so you can do that, you know, you can do the measurements in different ways. This one on paper is the stronger, like it's something like a 3 sigma, but there is an issue here, which is that this M is a killer, right? You don't really know, you have to take the Z flux and convert it into an M, a mass for the cluster, before you can make this prediction. And that conversion, that bias in the conversion is something that we don't know very well. If you take the current simulations, so there's the CCCP a prediction for it, then there is this tension between the data, between the measured Planck cluster abundance and the prediction from the CMB. However, if you take that bias factor and make it smaller by something like 10-15%, this is something that Jen and I worked on, then that tension goes away. Cosmic shear, any individual cosmic shear measurements, if you take, like, for example, KIDS or even the more recent Subaru measurements, they are in 2 sigma or less tension with the CMB. But together, there's a tendency for all of these guys to sort of cluster, all of the cosmic shear measurements to cluster lower than the CMB predictions. So if you're looking for a signal that will, you know, sort of tighten or maybe go away down the road, this is one avenue, right? And anytime you change the expansion rate, it's hard to imagine that you're not going to change the growth history. So these things are correlated if you're going to do something at late times, right? So this you know, this change in the growth rate, right? This is just the growth rate of fluctuations that directly feeds into the sigma 8. Right. So for this model that we cooked up, right, you can compute this. There's only one interesting thing to say, which is that most of the change in the cluster abundance doesn't really come from this change in the sigma 8 or the growth. It's coming from, so there's a volume factor here. You have to, for this, this is proportional to, it's really just coming from the change in the volume factor. So that's like a 10 to 15% change because you've changed the growth, you've changed the distances, right? This model also does predict the, if you just ask, like, you know, take the cluster abundance in this model, right? So this model where you have this transition in the equation of state, it looks like this. Then that predicts the right cluster abundance. And if you compare it to a lambda CDM model, the lambda CDM model that'll best fit it is something with a smaller sigma 8. So naively, without putting in a model, really, I'm just, what I'm telling you is the change in the distances explains away the cluster abundance. But remember, there's this issue with, like, you know, what do you really know the masses, right? So it's interesting. I mean, the change in H naught also solves the sigma 8 tension in the same way. But, you know, I don't really know what to make of something like this. You know, the kinds of models you're looking at are possibly, like, you know, something that was maybe -2 and then transitions. You know, why would the dark energy density do something like this? I don't know. You could try playing with, like, models where the dark matter isn't really going as 8 to the minus 3. This is allowed by all the data right now. And it's not surprising, by the way, if you ever do a parameter space with W not being a free parameter, it always comes out very negative. When you put all of the data sets together, there's a lot of space down there for, like, you know, negative W. So maybe it's not so surprising. But this one is, yeah, this one's allowed with current data. So it's close to -1 today, but it's at redshifts of 1 and beyond, it's many, very negative. I mean, it's just saying basically the dark energy goes away. There's, like, no, you know, it becomes matter, very matter dominated at Z of 2. So that's not. So I think one avenue might be that, you know, some small fraction of the dark matter isn't really at late times evolving as dark matter. It's somehow, like, changing its behavior, right? I mean, here we've assumed that the dark matter density is fixed. But if you don't assume that, then this is sort of an effective description of the entire picture, right? So in terms of model building, that might be one avenue, is to have some small fraction of the dark matter. So let's say there's a dark sector and the dark matter is a multi-component thing. So some small fraction of the dark matter do something different. Phase transitions happen, something happens. And if you... Yeah, I haven't read your paper in detail. Let's talk afterwards.
The curve looks very much like that. So
that's interesting. Yeah. And the only other place I've seen, like, things like this is sort of these modified gravity models with the scalar tensor. But they have an extra, you know, the extra degree of freedom does cause the growth rate to go up. So they're in tension with the ISW effects and things like that. So you need the change in expansion rate, but you don't want new degrees of freedom to change the growth, right? Which is why I'm thinking, like, the dark matter sector is probably, if you take this seriously, that's probably what you want to, like, the dark sector is what you want to look at. All right, I'm sorry I went over,
thank you.